We turn tonight to one of the professions, the law. There are about 115 members of the Kalamazoo Bar, and some lawyers are not members of the local bar. In addition to these, there are a sizable number of clerks, secretaries, and stenographers employed directly or indirectly by members of the legal profession here in Kalamazoo. Training for the legal profession requires between 6 and 7 years beyond high school. Following graduation from law school, the young lawyer has to study for and pass the state bar examinations before he can start to practice. All lawyers in Michigan have to belong to the State Bar of Michigan in order to have the right to practice their profession. On the national level, the American Bar Association is the principal national voluntary organization of lawyers, but there are several smaller ones. Local bar associations are voluntary groups, membership being by invitation. The Kalamazoo Bar Association holds monthly meetings at which new and interesting cases are discussed. Legal clinics or institutes are arranged at different places in the state from time to time by the state bar in order to keep the lawyers up to date on developments in the field. One typical clinic, which is going to be held in Battle Creek soon, will hear discussions on the work of the trial lawyer, the administration of bankruptcy cases, and the technique of cross-examination. Unlike physicians, lawyers are not required to go through a period of internship, although that's now being advocated in some quarters. Very often, however, a young lawyer will become attached to a law firm for a time, learn the ropes, so to speak, and then hang out his own shingle. There are a large number of attorneys who are connected with law firms. There are several advantages to this. The costs of a large law library can be shared. Stenographic help can be pooled. And to some extent, the several members of the firm may specialize in different kinds of law practice. A law firm is never a corporation, however. That would destroy the personal relationship between the lawyer and his client. The firm may consist of one lawyer who hires one or more other lawyers to assist him on a salary or other basis. It is usually a partnership, though. That's why you'll find law firms with a whole batch of names. In the larger cities, the big firms don't list all the partners, of course, because there are just too many for convenient use in common practice. The number of lawyers in proportion to the population has been steadily increasing, I'm informed. 25 years ago, the general run of a law practice consisted of collections, bankruptcy proceedings, divorces, settlement of estates, property transfers, and an occasional criminal suit. Nowadays, many lawyers spend most of their time outside their offices in hearings before state and federal administrative boards, such as the Public Service Commission, the Unemployment Compensation Commission, the Wage and Hour Division of the United States Department of Labor, and hundreds of others. Actually, only two kinds of specialized law practice are generally recognized, patent law and admiralty law. But most lawyers, especially those connected with firms, tend to specialize in certain kinds of law practice. If an attorney, for example, happens to be successful in one or two cases of a certain character, other clients are apt to seek his services for similar cases. One reason that people and corporations require so much legal counsel these days is that tax questions beset them on every hand. For instance, if an individual is making a will or arranging for the disposal of his property after his death, there are many problems involved in relation to taxes. He needs legal advice in order to find the way by which as little of his estate as possible under the law will be taxable. An important part of the expenses of any lawyer is the cost of his law library. One lawyer told me the other day that no attorney is ever out of debt to the book companies. He starts out with the 27 volumes of the annotated statutes of the state of Michigan. That's the law. Then he needs to have the decisions made by the Supreme Court interpreting those laws. There are about 326 volumes of these Michigan reports. He needs to have a digest of 20 volumes arranged topically so he can find the decisions on a certain type of case. Then he needs what's called a citator, which lists all the different cases down through the years in which a certain decision has been cited, so the lawyer will know if it ever has been overruled or superseded. The decisions of Michigan courts often are affected by decisions in other states, so the lawyer needs to have access, whether in his own library or elsewhere, to the so-called Corpus Juris, a 72-volume reference work to cases in all of the 48 states, or to other similar works, such as American Jurisprudence. Add to that the federal laws, the rulings of administrative boards and commissions, the decisions of federal courts, publications of legal organizations, and you have a simply staggering amount of printed matter to which the lawyer must have access in order to know the law on any case which may come into his office. We have with us as our guest tonight Attorney Edwin Gimmeridge, president of the Kalamazoo County Bar Association. And I'm going to ask him some questions about the practice of law right after this message from our sponsor. Mr. Gimmeridge, I would like to ask you first about lawyers' fees. What considerations determine the fees which lawyers charge?
Well, Dr. Dunbar, there are definite yardsticks by which lawyers measure their charges. In the first place, a lawyer's fees in the aggregate have got to be large enough to pay his fixed overhead, consisting of the cost of his library, rent, light, stenographer's salary, similar items, and still leave him enough left to support his family. In each community, local custom and economic factors are frequently established a pretty good measuring stick. Some local associations adopt suggested minimum fee schedules for the guidance of its members. Now, lawyers' fees are not as high as people sometimes think. Many think that you can't consult a lawyer for less than $25. Actually, in this community, I suppose the initial consultation with a lawyer would run anywhere from $2 to $5. With no previous agreement established between a lawyer and his client, a lawyer should be paid the reasonable value of his services, and in fixing that fee, he takes into consideration a number of factors, such as the time that he spent on the matter, the final results which he obtained for his client, the amount involved, the standing of the lawyer in his profession for learning, skill, and proficiency, the importance to his client of the particular litigation, and the responsibility that rests upon the attorney in handling the matter.
I suppose that there are a great many matters about the practice of law that the public misunderstands, Mr. Gimmeridge. For instance, I presume it's a mistake to assume that the only time the lawyer is working is when he happens to be in court swinging his arms and pleading a case.
Such an assumption certainly is a mistake. The actual trial of a contested lawsuit frequently consumes the very smallest portion of the time involved in handling the litigation. No lawyer worth his salt will try a case without thorough preparation. And a day's trial in court is frequently preceded by many days of intense preparation, including the drafting of pleadings, consultation with his client and with witnesses, time spent legal research on the problems that are involved, and marshaling the proofs. Of course, beyond that, the average lawyer spends only a comparatively small time, portion of his time, in actual court work. Some very eminent lawyers appear very rarely in court, either through choice or because the nature of their practice requires just infrequent court work. Their practice perhaps is devoted almost exclusively to aiding businessmen and carrying on their activities in this rather complex economy in which we live. Like doctors who practice preventive medicine, the lawyers seek to conserve their clients' time and money by keeping them from litigation in the first instance. Many people, particularly large corporations now, learned a long time ago that it was much cheaper to consult their attorney about how to keep out of trouble than to wait and go to the attorney after the trouble was started.
Now I'd like to ask you to tell our listeners a little more fully than I've done about the activities of the Kalamazoo County Bar, particularly the Legal Aid Bureau.
Well, Dr. Dunbar, for many years, Kalamazoo County Bar Association has maintained what we call a voluntary legal aid committee, to which local charitable organizations refer cases of indigent persons who need legal assistance, other than in criminal matters, of course, but who do not have the money to pay for it. Almost every member of our bar association has at some time or the other in his lifetime served as a member of this committee. If the person referred to the committee is actually in need of legal advice or service, and if he or she is actually unable to pay the same, our association seeks to provide that service so that no one will suffer an injustice or the loss of substantial rights because of poverty.
I think you told me before we went on the air that there's some consideration being given to expanding this service.
Yes, that's true. In many cities, there are presently established non-profit corporations which operate as legal aid bureaus, supported by organizations such as the Community Chest. These bureaus employ one or more full or part-time lawyers on a salary basis, and all cases of indigence needing legal services are processed through the bureau. Our own association has been conducting a survey in this community in an effort to find out whether our present voluntary system is actually filling the need for legal aid service. While the survey is not fully completed, It does indicate that there are many such cases which in the past have either been neglected or they've found their way into the office of the prosecuting attorney, adding to his burden, or into the probate court. And it would thus appear that a need for extended legal aid service exists, and a special committee of our association has been authorized to proceed with the development of a detailed plan to submit to the association.
Another question, Mr. Gemmerich. What about the lawyer's code of ethics, and how are violations of that code dealt with?
The lawyers, by statute, are officers of the court, and as such, of course, we are subject to its discipline. In Michigan, we have what is known as an integrated bar. You have to be a member of the State Bar Association of Michigan in order to practice law in the state and be subject to its rules. Through the integrated bar, we eliminate from our membership those who might otherwise bring our profession into ill repute. You know, under our statutes, there are many things which it is illegal for an attorney to do. But in addition, there are many things which would be perfectly legal for a businessman to do, but which lawyers can't do because such acts would be considered unethical. Typical, for example, is a solicitation of business. A successful merchant advertises, solicits business in every legal way, but such action on the part of a lawyer is unethical. These rules of conduct affecting lawyers are set forth in the Canons of Ethics of the American Bar Association, and they've been adopted by the State Bar Association of Michigan. Violations of an attorney's duties are punishable by suspension from the practice of law for a period of time or by a permanent disbarment, and hearings are had before a panel of three circuit judges. Our Kalamazoo County Bar Association also maintains a grievance committee, and complaints against local lawyers are heard by that committee. Lawyers are conscious and proud of the fact that the high standing of our profession is based primarily upon the trust and confidence which the public has in us. No other group of people, I believe, so uniformly are trusted with the secrets, welfare, money, and property of others. All of these measures which we provide for discipline and control over our members are based upon our desire to constantly maintain the standing of our profession at the very highest possible peak.
I see. Now, Mr. Gemmerich, suppose you introduce our other guest this evening.
Well, Dr. Dunbar, I'm glad to introduce to you John Bockham. John is a young lawyer in Kalamazoo. Born and raised in Royal Oak, Michigan, graduated from the University of Michigan in August of last year after spending 3 years in the Army, and was admitted to our local bar here in Kalamazoo in November of 49, along with a group of five other men who made up one of the largest classes we had. He's now associated with a Kalamazoo firm.
That makes him one of Kalamazoo's youngest lawyers, then.
Certainly does.
Well, welcome to Kalamazoo, Mr. Bockham. How'd you happen to choose this city in which to start practicing law?
Well, when I graduated from law school, I had pretty much in mind the kind of law firm I wanted to be associated with and the size and type of city that I wished to practice in. So I just began a little tour of the cities in Michigan and the law firms in those cities, which I thought might meet those standards. Although I went to quite a few of them, it just seemed to me that Kalamazoo and the firm of Adam Smith & Yenner came about as near as I thought possible to the standard that I had set, and so here I am.
What kind of law are you especially interested in?
Well, I'm mainly interested in that kind of law which is involved in the problem that is troubling the person who happens to come in my office door. However, seriously, if I had any choice in the matter, I believe I would prefer what you might call family or personal law. Domestic relations problems, planning estates for proper operation after the death of the head of the family, and drafting wills and things of that nature.
You happen to have a family yourself, Mr. Bockham?
Yes, I've been married to a very lovely wife for 6 years, and the latest estimate is that I am the father of a 7/9 more of a family. There is some doubt as to the number that is going to be in that family, too, but I understand you have to have quintuplets before the government will take over your responsibility.
Well, the best of luck to you, Mr. Bockham, and thank you for being with us. And our thanks also to you, Mr. Gemmerich, for your contributions to our program. And that's the story of one of the professions in which you will find Western Michigan at work.